All right. Okay. So, thanks everybody for joining us. Sorry not to see you in person again. And I know we've got a special guest with us today as well. We've got Counselor Baum, who's called in for the beginning of our meeting, and we'll talk a little bit about why we wanted to keep this moving and why the council wanted to keep this moving. So I'll let him speak in just a few minutes when I am going to introduce the meeting. And I think one other just logistical note, I think folks have probably got the hang of muting and unmuting at this point. Folks that are on the phone, please do mute on your end, particularly if you have just called in by phone, because when I mute you on the app, if there is background noise coming from your number and I have to mute you on the app, it can be a little hard for you to unmute yourself, and I would hate for that to happen. So please do use your own mute button so I don't need to do that. And then for committee members, I know folks have been missing the opportunity to have discussions in person, and I know there have been some concerns about not everyone having access to video in the past, but I thought we might try for this meeting to do videos on during discussion if you are able, just to make it feel a little bit more like humans talking. So you can make your own decisions about your video for now during presentations. But yeah, if you're comfortable and have a video available for the discussion section, that might help us feel more like we're actually talking to each other and less like we're talking to the void. So with that, the first order of business is our meeting summary from meeting six. And I did get one requested clarification from County Council to clarify that the population split is a split of population growth, not of existing population. So we will make that clarification. Are there any other comments or clarifications or corrections on the meeting summary? Okay, hearing none. Would anyone like to move to approve the meeting summary as is, except for that one clarification that I mentioned?
I'll move approval.
Thank you, Jim. Second?
I'll second it.
I'm sorry, I missed who that was. Was that Stephen Abramson?
Right.
Thank you. All right. And let's go all in favor.
Aye.
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 And any opposed? Okay. All right. Thank you. Our meeting today, I'm going to turn it to Councillor Blom in just a minute to kind of give you a little bit of a council perspective on the importance of today's meeting. But today's meeting is a pretty important one for us. We did send out a survey to you all in advance of this meeting to share kind of where things were headed and to offer an opportunity for feedback in advance of the meeting. We did get a number of you that participated, so thank you so much for taking the time to do that. And we are hoping to use your feedback from this meeting to test what the recommendations, the draft, not quite final recommendations, would look like and mean in terms of model results. So that's where we head next from here. And I'm going to turn it to Councillor Blom and then say a few more words about kind of how we're going to make decisions and recommendations through this meeting. So Councillor Blom, did you want to say a few words about council's perspective for this meeting and the process?
Yeah, thanks, Becky. Appreciate the opportunity to come and talk to the group. Want to say thank you for all of the work that this group has done. I don't think 2020 has gone the way that any of us expected, and I know when all of you generously volunteered your time to do this, the expectation was not that we were going to be sitting in front of laptops spread all over Clark County, but have the opportunity to be in the room together and discussing these really important issues that will shape the next comprehensive plan, and through that, shape what Clark County looks like for the next 10, 20 years. So want to give a big thank you, and I know this wasn't exactly what you all signed up for, but really appreciate the work that you've done. With that in mind, you know, at this point, this is the world that we are operating in, and we do need to continue to move forward. We have a deadline that, although it seems like it's years out there in terms of our next comprehensive plan update, there are a lot of check marks and milestones along the way that we need to meet. And I think one thing that we have found very much as a council over the last year is that while we're getting public input in different ways, it's taking a little bit longer to do that. And so we need to be able to continue to keep moving this process forward. So I've heard that there's, heard from some of you that there's concerns about this process and how good is the work product going to be, or is it going to be as good when we're all in person? But right now in 2020, this is where we are at. And so, again, I thank all of you for working hard and participating in this. But I also, I know from the council perspective, it's important that we do keep this moving, so that we can continue to hit those milestones to get towards, our next comprehensive plan update. This work is really the foundation of it. And I'm very confident that this group's going to make, great recommendations to the council in terms of running the model and coming up with, the guidelines for our next plan. So thank you for all of your work. Almost there, almost to the finish line. Appreciate the hard work in getting it done. And I know the council is very much looking forward to seeing what you come up with and seeing your recommendations.
All right. Thank you, Councillor Bond, for those words. I did want to just say a few more words about where we're going with this meeting. So I mentioned, that we're building on the feedback we got from the survey. We did provide a summary of that feedback as one of the, materials that was available online. And so we're trying to build on that feedback and clarify it where we maybe didn't get a full set of feedback. And I'm sorry, I'm getting a little bit of feedback from somebody, so I'm going to hit mute on a couple folks and see if that helps. Okay, let's try. Nope, still there. Okay. Okay, let's try now. This meeting is not our final decision point, but we are trying to narrow down the things that are on the table. Get to the point where we can test. We are planning to test, I guess, four things in the VBLM following this meeting. One is just the existing methodology. So that's sort of our base. And then option one is, the sort of what we think we have the most agreement on, and anywhere where we don't really have agreement, we'll stick with the existing methodology, the existing assumptions. And then option 2A and 2B are ways of testing things that we have some support for, but not full support for, not enough for a recommendation. So 2A is things where the project team recommends it, we have some support from the committee, but maybe not everyone agrees with it. Option 2B is whether or not the project team agrees. It doesn't necessarily mean the project team is opposed to it, but maybe it doesn't quite align with the analysis that the project team has done. But if there's at least two of the committee members that want to see that tested, then we can include it in option 2B. So that's our plan there. I want to note that 14 is the number of members that we theoretically have on this committee. We had one just in the last week say that he's no longer planning to participate, so that puts us at 13. And in our protocols, it is two-thirds of the members present that we are looking for I'm going to do a quick double check to see Ryan Meckenster or Jerry Olson. Have you joined us at this point?
I talked to Jerry an hour or so ago, and he was planning to attend.
Okay, well, we'll check in one more time when we get to the discussion section and see if we have him.
I know Ryan is going to be a little bit late. He has another meeting okay. He's attending before this, but he should be here for the end.
Okay, great. Okay, well, I'm glad he'll be able to join us. Thank you for those updates. So it looks like right now I think we have 11 of you. Hopefully we will get to 13 by the time we are looking to get feedback from you. But in order for something to make it into our option one, which is kind of where we think we have consensus and then defaulting back to existing methodology where we don't, we would be looking for 2/3 of however many of you there are when we get there. So any questions about just sort of how this meeting is going to work and what we are, there are probably some questions about exactly what these options are going to mean, but we're going to run them through the VBLM and test and see how much difference it makes. That'll be, I think, helpful for some of us to see, is this a big swing or a small swing? So, questions. I see David McDonald, you've got a hand raised. Go ahead, please.
Thank you, Becky. A couple of things. First, I apologize. I somehow missed the survey email, and so I did not participate in it. That's my fault. I do apologize for that, for not getting you my feedback, but I have reviewed the survey and the results, so just so you know that. Secondly, I've looked through a lot of these documents, and some of them seem to me to be hard to cross-reference, the memorandum. So, for instance, if you're talking about something today, and it's on the presentation that you have now up on the screen. If you could somehow reference where that would be on both the table with the option one, option 2A and option 2B, and maybe even refer it back to which are those questions were on the survey, because I wasn't able to track through all of that together. Maybe that's just, I'm not very capable, but if you could help with that sort of cross-referencing, because I have all the documents out, that would be helpful to me. That's all I have. Thanks.
We'll try and do that. And I realize, yeah, the survey, we tried to be comprehensive and include everything. The memo had only things where we had sort of new information to share. So it was already sort of a difference between what was in the survey and what was in the memo. And then I know the options was sort of another way of organizing the information, and this PowerPoint is organized in yet a third way. I apologize for that confusion. The reason the PowerPoint is organized the way it is that we heard some of you in the last meeting wanting to have more discussion about certain topics. We tried to prioritize the topics where we thought we would have the most discussion and put those first. So I do apologize that it is a bit to do to track everything through, and we will try and make note of where you can find these things as we go.
Okay. Thank you. I appreciate that.
Any other questions about just what we're doing in this meeting and what we're trying to accomplish and how we're going to run the meeting? Okay. All right. So the topics, I mentioned we're taking these in a slightly different order. This is how we're organizing the topics. First up, we're going to talk about market factor, critical lands, and infrastructure deductions. Again, taking that first because there's some meaty conversation to be had there, we think, and we look forward to your comments. And then we're going to have a little 5-minute break once we've gotten through that. And then we'll talk about the redevelopment and residential and commercial areas, and then the residential and employment land classifications and density, and then wrap up by confirming our options for testing. And for folks to just sort of have a idea of how this is going to go, for each of these topics, we'll have a little brief presentation from the project team and then pause for some discussion. And we'll ask for whether you support the recommendation. And we'll keep track of that and use it to kind of see, okay, does this recommendation have enough support that we think it makes it in our kind of option one things that most people agree to, or does it fall into one of the other categories? So we'll do that kind of as we go and then wrap up and share back what we think we heard at the end. So I'm hoping, I'm going to try to keep us moving through because it's really important that we get to the point where we have some direction from you about what to test. Jim Malinowski, I see you have a hand raised. Go ahead, please.
Yes, at a previous meeting, we were promised we're going to address, you were going to address rural issues, and I don't see that on this list.
Jose, I'll give you a chance to comment on that in a minute, but one other important thing about today's meeting is that there are a couple topics that we have discussed that do not directly find their way into the vacant buildable lands model, even if they are part of the report or part of the later comprehensive plan process. And today's meeting prioritizes things that we can test in a model because that is our next step, is to test things in the model. But Jose, did you want to make any other comments about addressing rural issues?
So I think we addressed the rural capacity estimate. I don't know if it was a meeting, I think in July, where we went over how we're estimating capacity in the rural area. So I'm not sure what, in addition to that, you think we're needing to discuss. I think I've made it clear that changing zoning is not part of this. How we're treating employment historically in the rural area has been addressed. If there are any changes into how we calculate rural capacity, sort of we're open to that. But I don't think I heard any comment at that meeting about making any changes to how we are currently estimating rural capacity.
That's not what I remember. The concern I have is that we in the rural areas want to see the opportunity for jobs. We've got the rural centers, we've got Salache Prairie, and we've got the railroad. Those are all rural-related issues, it seems to me that the focus right now is on Vancouver, and I don't see that that we're really addressing what happens in the rural areas.
Right. Yeah. So all of those areas that you mentioned are currently zoned for commercial or industrial development. And like I said before, if the council doesn't have a capacity or attribute employment to the rural area, that would be something that they would have to do. We, like I said, are tracking employment overall, but we don't have any assumptions for employment density in the rural area. And so it's not to say that it wouldn't happen, but the fact that it's already zoned for that anticipates that development would happen. So nothing that we're doing here is going to recede from that or take anything away from what's already planned.
Okay, well, I won't pursue it any longer, but I'm not satisfied that the rural areas are being adequately addressed to this process.
Okay, and I think if there are any specific methodology issues that you wanted to see addressed related to the capacity analysis for rural areas, maybe you can send those to Jose. Yeah, they're not the focus of today's meeting because we're focused on things that are going into the model. I have a little bit of background noise coming from somebody with a 9240 number. If you can mute yourself, that'll save me having to mute you in a way that you may not be able to undo very easily later. Thank you. Okay. All right. So with that, I'm going to keep us moving. First up, we're going to talk about market factor and critical lands. So for navigational purposes, this is found in page 8 of our PAC meeting 7 memo, and in the survey results, it is on page 7 and 8 of the survey results document. So market factor, we're going to talk about market factor and then pause, have a little bit of discussion, and then move on to critical lands. They're related in the way that the model works right now, which is why we've kind of bundled them together, but we are going to address them separately and have present them separately and have a separate discussion about them. I wanted to note that market factor in particular, the primary reason to revisit this is that the updated guidance from the state does put an emphasis on showing your work for market factor and providing a good evidence base for the assumptions. And so that's where that's why the focus here and why this has come up for discussion. So there's no reason we can't keep the assumptions we have if we have a good basis for them, but it's not really an option for us to just assume that they're fine as is without any further evidence. So with that, I am going to turn it over to Jose to share some of the new analysis that that staff has done.
All right, thanks, Becky. So what we decided to do was look at a more specific area. We chose this area in Northeast, the Vancouver UGA. And the idea was to look in more detail to see if we could support the current assumptions for sort of the market factors, which are never to convert factors over the 20-year period, and then the critical lands deductions. This area is roughly 600 acres that was brought into the urban growth boundary in 2004, and it was in urban holding until late 2007. So development didn't start till after that. The area includes 43 residential development projects, they're including multi-phase projects, all but 4 are platted subdivisions. The balance are apartment complexes on the north, the northwest corner. We did include one subdivision to the south in that green area, Austin Heritage. In when it was first brought into the urban growth boundary, it was zoned for mixed use, and then there was a comp plan amendment to change it, but we didn't include any, we didn't count that in any of the numbers for that, but we're just showing it. Let's see what else is there. I think that's it. The only other thing I would say is the two subdivisions on the far east side, the Urban Oaks and the Dunning Meadows, were areas that were added as part of the 2007 comp plan update. So they weren't part of the original 2004 expansion. So that came; those two came a little later. So next slide. So when we looked at that area, the like I said, there were 604 total acres of residential gross acres. The vacant and underutilized. What we're showing essentially is that the rate of development, which is for vacant, we assume that 90% of vacant land will develop within the 20-year period. Underutilized, we assume that 70% will develop within the 20-year period, and we're showing 79 and 61%. which is relatively high, but sort of expected because most of this is greenfield development, and we'd expect it to go faster in the earlier years. And so we think it's in line with the never to convert factors, the market factors of 90 and 70%. And you know, and if you project it out from the 13 years of data that we've seen, it falls in line with that. So next slide. So the one other thing with regard to market factor that has been brought up previously is that there was a chart that shows capacity over time, 2000, going back to 2003, and that there was a 45,000 population capacity that was being reflected in the 2003 to 2006 period. And that there was a difficulty in finding land at that time to develop, and so that we should adjust the market factor based on that. One of the things I went back and looked at were, at that time, there were some issues that were going on. Like I said, the area that we looked at in the study area was brought into the urban growth boundary in 2004. In 2004, there was a 6,000 acre expansion countywide. In Vancouver UGA, that was about 3,100 acres. It wasn't all residential, but like I said, this study area is about 600 acres of that land that was brought in at that time. And it was an urban holding. So it would show up in the model as being available land to develop, but in actuality wasn't available. And the model doesn't distinguish between land that's in urban holding and land that's not. So that's one issue. And that was just Vancouver. A lot of the other UGAs have a similar roughly 30% of the land that they have available is in urban holding. And I'll talk about Richfield more specifically in a minute. The other thing that was going on at the time, there was a development moratorium in the Salmon Creek area, roughly 26 months. Is that 2004? Yeah, in 2005, there was a 26-month development moratorium having to do with the lack of infrastructure or capacity, and that's sort of what necessitated the building of the 139th Street interchange. And so there was no development that could happen in that area at that time as well. So it's another situation where the land that was available there was still showing up in the model as being available, even though it wasn't because of the moratorium. In Richfield, they're having sewer issues at that time. And so some of the development, what we've seen is that the development that's happened in Richfield in the last 10 years has been primarily within the 1994 UGA boundary, but the development had been slow because they didn't have the sewer line connection there. They had one existing sewer, and then a lot of the newer development is being piped into to a larger facility in I-5, and that's going to the waste treatment plant. So that area had been in their urban growth boundary. It wasn't an urban holding, but a lot of it wasn't developable because of the lack of sewer. The other issue is, so when we're looking at market factor, we're looking at sort of the 20-year plan. The model can't really distinguish these nuances. So it's really difficult to make kind of an argument based on that sort of one point in time looking at the capacity. So this is sort of an indication of how urban holding has evolved within the Vancouver UGA. Like I mentioned, there was the expansion and part of the 2004 comprehensive plan added about 3,100 acres in the Vancouver UGA. In 2007, there was a 12,000 acre expansion countywide, and 4,000 of that was added to the Vancouver UGA. So with the exception of remand in 2009, where we were found to be non-compliant with the Growth Management Act, and we had to put back just under 1,000 acres, these are a list of when urban holding has been removed and how that's evolved over time. The most recent urban holding removal is dealing with the 179th Street area, and that was about 2,000 acres that was just removed from urban holding March of this year. So the, Becky, you want to go over the recommendations?
Sure. Yeah, so this just summarizes where the recommendations sit right now based on the information that Jose just presented. The recommendation is to maintain the existing never-to-convert factors for vacant and underutilized residential land. Those are 10% for vacant, 30% for underutilized. As Jose said, that falls roughly in line with what you would expect based on the observed data. And then the other recommendation, which would not be addressed in the VBLM itself, but is a recommendation for council to consider at the time of doing the comprehensive plan update, is to eliminate the demand side assumption of a 15% market factor in addition, because the evaluation that Jose just described doesn't support an additional 15% on top of what's in the model. So I think we wanted to open it up for some discussion and then just see where we're sitting with support for this. In the survey, I will note that there was some confusion on this because we bundled together the market factor piece that we just talked about and some refinements on the critical lands that we're going to get to in just a minute. So the market factor piece, I think it's not clear whether we've got support for this. On the other hand, this is the default position, is to retain the existing recommendation. So I think what we wanted to hear is just if folks support this, if they have an alternative that they would want to see, or if they have questions. So I'll give a chance for folks that are raising hands, and then we'll do a go around. Eric Lamo, I see that you have a question. Go ahead, or a comment.
I do. You know, a few things. First, when you're looking at the data, the area you looked at was that North Orchards area that is not really a good representation of what typically happens in these areas and what's happened historically. So this particular area was basically teed up for development. It was developer driven. It was owned by developers. It was very obvious that when this area was brought in, it was going to develop. There was DAs. It was years in the making. this is not a typical area that I would base your decisions on for the entire UGA. So yeah, this is going to have a much higher percentage. That chart that we talked about that we based it on, that had that kind of 57% level on it at that 40,000, and the one that kind of Jose, I guess, was kind of dismissing is, oh, there are a lot of reasons for it. Well, there's always a lot of reasons. To tell you the truth, if the urban holding or annexation, that's a typical thing. When something's brought into the urban growth boundary, it's always put into either urban holding or it is in an area that needs to be annexed before it's actually brought in. The anticipation is that is going to happen in a 20-year period. Now, last time, there were development moratoriums and lack of infrastructure. Those areas, if they are not planned to be served in a 20-year period, they should not be in the urban growth boundary. So those, some of those areas should have been replaced with areas that we could have developed. Not that the demand wasn't there. So I just think we're basing these decisions on kind of erroneous assumptions. The other thing too is the reason why we're here and the reason why this bill was passed at the state level is because it became pretty apparent that we had a lack of buildable land in the county and across the state. And we had big problems with affordable housing and land availability. So we had to go look at these variables. And when I'm looking through this, if we go with these new recommendations, one, we're keeping it as is for the existing never to convert. And then we're eliminating the 15. So we're making it worse for available land and worse for affordable housing by going with these new recommendations. So I would say, no, I would not support them. I think we need to look at something kind of even more than that, because I can tell you from looking out there, looking from being in the trenches, looking at land feasibility, looking at what's actually available, looking at the if they're selling it, are they selling it at a reasonable price? These areas are not converting as quickly as we say. And it's the assumption that 70% or even 60% of the land that's brought in is going to convert is really not a good assumption at all. It's really closer to, let's see, yeah, maybe around six, maybe around half of the property to 50% or 40 to 50% of it converts. So something's wrong in these numbers and it's not correlating to reality.
Eric, can I ask, do you have, just knowing that we need to provide an evidence base for the recommendations and for the assumptions, you noted some concerns about whether the area that staff used is representative. Do you have anything? I mean, I think we can test an alternative if we have an evidence base to support it. That is something we can point to. I think the question is how would we operationalize that? How do we take that and say, you know, especially given the notes that Jose raised about some of the factors that meant that land wasn't available in that year, but that doesn't mean it wasn't available over a 20-year period. So how do we get to something that gives us an estimate of a 20-year horizon and is also, I would say, the other concern we have is that the way that the UGAs have been sized historically has intentionally brought in land above and beyond what was anticipated to be needed. And so it's a little bit hard to say that, because if you bring in 20% more than you think you need and that additional 20% doesn't get used, that means you were probably right about what you needed and you have this. So it's, we don't want to build in, oh, well, 20%, that extra 20% won't convert. It didn't, so it's hard to tell what didn't convert because it wasn't needed and what didn't convert because of other reasons. So I'm curious if you have evidence that would help us kind of parse that out.
Well, I think for one, it's a lot of the area that's brought in that didn't convert wasn't because there wasn't demand. It was because there wasn't a viable infrastructure and capital facilities plan associated with it. And because of that, a lot of these areas just basically didn't convert at all. So they really should have never been in there. if they were unlikely to convert in that period. So there is a little bit of that skew in the data as well. It is a tough one to decide, but I can tell you looking at this particular one and saying, okay, this is how things normally go, that is not the case. That is not how things typically go. It's somewhere kind of in between those two. And if I was going to make just a, you know, from observations, I would expect that to not convert to be somewhere. I mean, right now we're at what, 30, 45%, 30, if we do 30 for under or 30 for underutilized with that 15%, that's 45. I would say that's closer in line. I would say 45 to 60% do not convert is probably in the range. By eliminating that 15%, we're going in the wrong direction. We're significantly impacting the affordability of the land that's out there by artificially constraining the supply. What that results in is increase in land prices, less competition, higher prices, and less affordable housing. So I wouldn't say, you know, you need to have more of it in there just to compensate for the stuff that won't develop and is not available for development.
Okay, and I see David McDonald, you've got a hand raised as well. Go ahead, please.
So first, you know, I've been involved in this since before the passage of the Growth Management Act in this county, and I've heard the same arguments come from from Eric and people that preceded him in this processes over the time, and this is my second vacant buildable lands analysis committee. And what I have found is that there are claims about those things, but I haven't seen them translate on the ground. So for instance, you know, if he says they're developer driven and they have developer agreements and they come after years of practice, sometimes that's true. I mean, we look at 179th Street Corridor right now, and all of that land was, you know, designated specifically for some commercial and some residential. There are multiple development agreements. And that land is going to be developed in a particular way as long as they can pass through with the environmental constraints and whatever else is out there. So then I looked at all the other counties that use these market factors, and most of them have lower market factors than we do here in Clark County. And we have a lot of space in Clark County that's being brought in regularly that is ready to develop and has that infrastructure. And over the 20-year period, I have not found and I have not seen that the statements that Eric's making today that I've heard for 20 years have come to fruition, because we have still in this area substantially less prices on homes, which is why we have many people wanting to come from the Portland area into our area. If you look just at the Ridgefield area right now, the homes that are up there are in the, you know, early, you know, the low to high 300s. That's not what we really call affordable housing. That's not what we're talking about when we talk about affordable housing for people who are on the streets. But we have large inventories of homes that are going in that take that 20-year period. And this market factor is double dipping. That's all it is doing. And over time, as Jose has pointed out, as has been shown in the other counties, as had been done by this team, is that this 15% market factor is an extra add-on, because Clark County back in the day added the 10% for not to convert for vacant land and the 30% for underutilized, because they were ahead of their time in doing a market factor. And then when the 15% came up, many people decided that's a way to get more land in and expand the urban growth boundary. And that's just not the point of it.
All right. So I have, Eric, I'm not sure if you've re-raised your hand. I'm going to take comments from folks that haven't spoken yet. And then when we do the go around at the end, I'll give you a chance for an additional word then. I see Ron Barker and Jen Baker, and then Jamie Housley after that. And I will say, I'd encourage folks, I do want to allow for discussion on this. It's really important, but I would also encourage you to try to keep your comments as brief as you can, as succinct as you can, because we have several other meaty topics to go. So Ron Barker, go ahead, please.
All right. Thank you. I just briefly wanted to say that, the market factor value is important, but we have never been saddled with the responsibility of trying to come up with an inventory of land that makes affordability a reality. I would really appreciate if we would keep the affordability question with the separate task force that's already working on affordability and not have us be the group that tries to figure out another way to get affordable. When you have the entire metro region looking at Clark County as a place to come and live, I don't know that we have any kind of appropriate answer for affordability, but I would really like us to look at market factor just in the aspect of, have we had an inventory of land ready to consume and has it been adequate? That's all I got. Thanks.
Thanks, Ron. And I do want to note on both your point and Eric's previous one, I think it is important to differentiate between having the land in an urban growth area and having it served and available, and that there is an additional hurdle that has to be crossed to make land available for development, and that can be an expensive one. And I think we're all aware of that, but just wanted to point out that the market factor that we are talking about is just about getting the land into the urban growth area, and it does not ensure that that land gets served. Let's see. So Ron Barker, I think you just spoke, so I'm going to lower your hand. Jen Baker, go ahead, please.
Hi there, Becky. A little bit just tagging on to what you just summarized. In CREDC's analysis of industrial lands, between 2016 and 2019, there was a considerable number of lots that we pulled out of the 2019 inventory manually, because the model would show that they were available industrial lands, but the actual buildability of that land and the timeline for being able to realize development on that land was disproportionate to anyone's ability to actually do it, or the timeline disincentivizes investment in the land. And I think that's the discussion that we're having right now. But in CRDC's practice, we had to manually sample out industrial land that was technically zoned industrial and available to develop, but wouldn't realistically develop because of infrastructure constraints.
Now I'm unmuted. Thank you for that comment. Jamie Housley, go ahead, please.
Yeah, I think when I first read the report here that suggested taking out the market factor, I was a bit dumbfounded because actually I couldn't find a rationale for it in the written materials. And I know that Mr. McKinster and I are been attending a Washington Growth Management Policy Framework plan that was a direct outgrowth from the bill that just passed a few years ago to talk about reforms to GMA, but particularly it was focused on housing. And one of the slides that I thought was very instructive actually came out of Snohomish County that is sort of consistent with that slide that Jose mentioned at the beginning. It sort of contradicts what my good friend David was saying about the demand side of things. And again, it shows a direct correlation between the sinking supply and rising prices and you know, the incomes it needs to sort of to chase things. And so it seems rather foolhardy to me from that standpoint that we're eliminating a tool that has been justified plan after plan, legally defended plan after plan, as a means of trying to achieve the housing goal, which is going to get amplified and become more important as we go forward. And I suspect we're going to see legislation that says as such. So I strongly think that it needs to remain there. And, you know, absent a good justification, which was not provided in the memorandum, I don't see any reason to remove it.
Okay. Thanks, Jamie. I will say that the justification for removing it is mostly that we did not find evidence to support it in the analysis that's been done so far. So it's not necessarily that there is something that says it definitely isn't there, but there's nothing to really support to support adding it. It was never really intended as a way to reflect land that would not develop, in my understanding of it. I think it was always intended as a way to provide sort of a margin for error, and the analysis that that Jose presented just doesn't,
I would strongly suggest that the county talk with Ms. Cook then, because I do not think that that is the intent of the legislation on this particular issue, especially as it relates to housing. The purpose of the goal should be to try to find tools and methods to increase the supply of viable housing. By eliminating a market factor here, you are effectively doing the opposite of that, and I do not think that'll be compliant.
Okay, so let's see. We've got one more comment. Ryan, is that Ryan McInster? Are you with us now?
I am. I was a little
okay.
bit up that.
I had Thanks a for joining us, my Ryan. Lap. That's okay. Eric, let us know you were going to join us a little bit late. So thank you for being
thank
here.
Thank you, Eric.
Go ahead, please.
I think this is more on process or kind of this data set. Unfortunately, unlike most of the people on this call, I'm fairly new to this process. I've only been here in this position for a few years. And so, looking at that was used as an example or an analog for future development, what other data sets were out there that did we not include? I'm sure everybody else on this call probably knows the other things out there, and I'm probably sounding naive, but I was kind of wondering, since we chose this one, are there other data sets out there, and which ones did we choose not to include, and kind of why? I know I sound kind of late to the game on that.
I'll let other folks chime in if they want to add, Jose or others, but I wish there were a lot of data sets to choose from. Staff picked a sample area because there isn't a great existing data set that goes back 20 years and answers all of the questions that we chose not to base things on. We looked at this two ways. So in a previous analysis, we tried to staff had compared vacant land now compared to vacant land in 1994 or six, I've now forgotten which, within the 1996 urban growth area. And we presented that analysis, but there were a couple of things that made that maybe not reflective of what our understanding of the market factor, what it's supposed to capture. So then this is a staff second round of analysis to try to get at more specifically this kind of what land does not convert over time and will not become available for development. So those are the two data sets that we have at this point. And there are not others that I am aware of that we considered and dismissed.
Oh, okay. Well, that actually changes my whole thought process then. That sounds like the... basically research issue of looking for your car keys under the street lamp issue. And I remember when this process was being put together and the council discussed using a contractor which is obviously a great idea, and you guys, this is no slight on you, but they were told that research was going to be done along the lines. The contract was to deal with research that you didn't currently have and that staff were unable to do themselves. That was specifically brought up in these conversations. And now we're relying on data from the staff when we have a very well-known and highly thought of consultant working on it. That causes me bewilderment. I'll leave it at that.
Yeah, I think the issue is the data availability itself and having a way to go back 20 years and dial in on exactly what we are trying to ask, which is what land, you know, was theoretically able to convert but did not. So, it is maybe more challenging than it seems on its face. I don't see other hands raised, and I want to. Oh, I see. Okay, Brian has an actual hand raised. Go ahead, Brian, and then I want to do our go around.
I'm not finding my virtual hand here, so I just had to do that. The just a couple of points. I think we're conflating the data part of this and the technical part of this with the policy implications. And the recommendations, I understand, it isn't to eliminate market factor. It's to eliminate the demand side part of it and to keep the supply side part of it, the 10% and the 30%. And unless there's pretty clear evidence that the sample area was inappropriate, I think that's the recommendation is where the data takes us. Now, in terms of the policy implications, a couple of things. I think I was part of the state committee that produced some of the recommendations. I think part of that document talks about the need for justifying this, as all you've said, in terms of policy implications, in terms of technical backing rather than necessarily the policy side. I think a couple things on the policy side. There's a couple of built-in safeguards into the system to help ensure that there is adequate land. The biggest one of those is that the land supply has to, under the law, get resized every 20 years. So every 20 years, you get a new year, required to have a new 20-year land supply. I think that's important to keep in mind. I think the other is the key to local decision about how much land is ultimately rolled out rests with the county commissioners in terms of their growth forecasts. The hearings boards have already said that choice of a forecast is in part a policy decision. And so this all, not just market factor, but I think all of our assumptions should be relatively policy neutral to the extent we can make them. They should be our best guess based on the data of how much land is needed to support a given population and or a given jobs forecast, and let the forecast be chosen with those policies in mind. So I support the recommendation.
All right. So I'm going to wrap us up on this point with a kind of go around. And I would say, if you can say whether you support the recommendation as written, or if you would like to, if you have an alternative recommendation that you would like to see tested in the VVLM, I would note that while we could test an alternative, we would, as folks have said, we would need to justify and support that alternative with some facts. So I'm going to go in the order that I have folks listed on my little tracking sheet here, and just ask folks to let us know just very briefly whether you want to support this or propose an alternative. So Marjorie Liddell, you are listed first on my list.
I support it.
Thank you. Ron Barca, you are next.
I support it as recommended.
Thank you. Eric Galamo, I think we have you as a no. Did you want to propose an alternative?
Yeah, for testing? I think I would. First, I could get behind maintaining the existing never convert factor. I do not agree with eliminating the demand side assumption. There's a factor that's missing in here, and it's still in here. And that is, and we talked about it. There was staff basically said that, well, the reason it didn't develop is because there wasn't infrastructure there. What factor do we have in here besides this one here to show that areas where infrastructure will not likely be financially feasible or available to develop these properties in that time period? There's no factor there. So by eliminating that, that's what this factor is really saying. And if you look at it, the data sampling size that North Orchards is not accurate. It is closer to 50% of the area that it develops. So using 45% makes sense. If I'm okay with eliminating the demand side factor, as long as we add this 15 into the other ones, because it is kind of just out of the blue. But when you look at the data and you look at how areas have gone over the last 20 years, not just this North Orchards, it's about 50%. So at the least, that factor should not go below the 45 that we currently have.
And so Eric, if I can summarize back what I think I'm hearing, I would note that you're talking about something that is addressed in the rules and as an infrastructure deficiency. The problem is that if a jurisdiction were to argue that they can't serve an area for not just 5 years, but 20 years, as you've pointed out, it shouldn't be in the boundary. And so that's sort of inherent conflict there. Can I propose something that I think is in line with what you're saying, and you tell me if it is? I think what you're suggesting is that for lands that are in an urban holding zone that don't have infrastructure, that you would want to see a higher number for those areas, and that that might be closer to 45 or 50% for areas in an urban holding zone. Is that consistent with what you're thinking?
That's basically everything, though, that's brought into an urban growth boundary. Almost everything that's brought in.
But it's not all the vacant land, right? Because there is also vacant land that's already in a...
Like infill type
land. Right. So is that consistent with what you're thinking, that for areas that are in urban holding, that you would apply a higher market factor to reflect the fact that it will take some time for them to get infrastructure?
Well, I don't know that we have the data to get that deep into the weeds. What I can say is, looking at in the last 20 years, what has and hasn't developed, the stuff that's been brought in, when you look at the information we have, it's closer to 45%. The 30% or 10% is not even in the ballpark, I don't think.
Would you like to propose as your alternative, which again, we would still need some additional support for, that it would be 30 and 45% across the board, or that it would be 30 and 45% in the urban holding areas?
I think at the least we should leave it unchanged and keep what we have now, which is the 30% underutilized, 10%.
Keep the 15% in.
What's that?
You're saying to keep the 15% in.
Keep the 15%, yes.
Okay. Yep. Okay. Thank you for clarifying. Okay, Jennifer Baker, you're next on my list. Can I get your, whether you support the recommendation as written or want to propose an alternative?
I don't have a proposed alternative. I would like to withhold my support until we have the critical lens conversation.
Okay.
These two enmesh. So I would just like to pause on support for this one at the moment.
Okay, I will say that this recommendation as framed right now would apply to lands that are not critical. So if that helps you make a decision about this one, we will have an opportunity to make a separate recommendation about the critical land. So this would just apply to land that's not mapped as critical. Would you still like us to come back to you after that conversation?
Yes, please.
Okay, thank you. All right, Jeff Swanson, can I get your take on this, please?
Yeah, I'm supportive of the staff recommendation.
Thank you. Okay, Jim Malinowski, can I get your recommendation, please?
Yeah, I oppose and I go along with Eric, leave the 15% in.
Okay, all right, we've got two behind that one, so that sounds like that might make our alternative 2B. Ryan Davis, what's your take?
Yeah, hi. So after listening to all the insight, I guess technically I'm a no. I would lean towards that middle ground, which is at least maintaining the 15%. I would agree with the suggestion that taking that off the table, from a real world, what's actually unfolded, might result in us moving backwards in terms of opening up rural lands. Buildable lands, I should say. So, to me, maintaining the 15% market factor is an appropriate middle ground.
Okay. All right. And Stephen Abramson, you're next.
From what I understand, I support, Eric's, proposal of maintaining.
Which is 15%. To basically keep the existing methodology of 10-30 plus a 15% on the demand side. Okay.
Correct.
Thank you. Brian Snodgrass, I think we heard from you that you support the recommendation. Anything you wanted to add to that? Or are you good as is?
I'm good.
Thank you. Okay, David. Oh, I'm sorry, Jamie Housley, you're next on my list.
I support Eric's.
Okay. David McDonald, what's your take?
I support the recommendation as it is.
Okay, thank you. And Ryan McInster? Still with us? Ryan, I think you are on mute. Ryan McInster, if you're...
Sorry about that, everyone. With the lack of knowledge about this and the data, I got to say, stay with the 15% as we are kind of status quo, because I don't feel comfortable enough either way right now to make a decision on that. So that's where I stay.
Okay. All right, thank you. And Jerry Olson, I think, is still not with us. Is that correct, Jerry Olson? If you are on the line, please speak up. Okay, I think still.
Can you hear me?
Oh, yes. There you are. Is that you?
I have spent the whole hour listening, trying to talk, and I
called
in five times, and I finally called in one last time, and so I got unmuted.
Okay, well, thank you. I apologize that you had trouble with that. Please go ahead.
I completely agree with Eric. I was part of the development of the sample area. We were all keyed up and ready to go, chomping at the bit. So that area had a huge head start and was not typical. I disagree with basic, well, I agree to keep the existing proposals. I'd probably make the market factor higher. One thing we haven't mentioned is the evidence that Eric brought up of the correlation between housing prices and the inventory. And as it got to a certain level, which was far higher than the 10 or 30%, is when the housing prices started to skyrocket. Okay.
All right, Jerry, I think we've got you as a prefer the existing methodology. So thank you for that. I'm glad you're able to be heard now. I will say, if you want to make sure I don't inadvertently leave you stuck on mute, please go ahead and mute your phone on your end, because I know it's hard to unmute if you're on the phone and I have to mute you. Okay, so we are supposed to take a break now. We have got through one of three of the meaty topics. If folks need to take a quick bio break, because we're going to be at this for a long time, I would say go ahead, take your bio break now, and try to get back as quick as you can, because I am going to keep us rolling. Critical lands is up next. So Jose, maybe you can do a brief version of sharing the analysis. I think this is one where we need to maybe give some clarification for folks about what the actual proposal is. So maybe you can just cover the analysis briefly, and we can try to make sure we're clear about what exactly we're recommending here.
Okay. Thanks, Becky. So the first thing is that really, critical lands is a misnomer. This is actually land that the model thinks may be critical, but critical lands rolls off the tongue a little better. And what we've looked at here is that when we looked at the vacant and underutilized, the critical really works more, it didn't matter whether it was vacant and or utilized. Critical was the overwhelming factor, and it's really more of the rate of development for critical. The existing assumption of that we're currently using of 50%, it's really more of it. Half of it is going to develop over the 20-year period, so that's really the reduction, and the data seems to support that in the study area. The next slide. So when I said that, what the critical area is lands that are that may be critical, this chart shows that the development, this is all critical area, 35% of it on average over the 20 years ends up preserved as open space. And those are the areas that are more likely to be actual critical, where you have wetlands and things that we're trying to protect. And the rest of it, the remainder, the 65%, goes into infrastructure or housing. And that's reflected in the study area where there were some examples of a couple of developments, Urban Oaks and Fieldstone Estates, that had a seems like a high percentage or a high amount of critical that was identified, but it didn't turn out to be when people got on the ground and looked at it. So I think looking at this methodology of categorizing critical lands as more of a rate of development to start with, and that's how we get to our 50%, and then allocating the 35% into the open space category, better captures what's happening on the ground. And so it eliminates that the 10 and 30% for vacant and underutilized that we've been using in the past. And I think we have data that supports that. And so I think it'll enable us to better be able to categorize this and evaluate this over time. The next slide. So this is just, while what we looked at, it was an aggregate, this is just kind of showing a sample of how a site could develop. If the area in green is critical, the 50% would develop on the yellow side. The green would be the 35% that's, that'd be the open space, and the remainder would develop as either infrastructure or lots. And this is sort of reflective of what the chart has shown before.
And if I could just add on, because I think a couple of folks had questions about this.
Yeah.
And sort of the why are there two different factors piece of it. And I want to see if I can just add one more way of saying that, in hopes that one of these ways will connect with for people. That the first analysis Jose showed was that half of the land does not become part of the development, and that the second chart showed that of the land that does go into a development, into a plat, 35% of it ultimately gets preserved as open space, and then the balance of it develops like other land, and so it would have streets and whatever else in it. So that's sort of trying to just show how those pieces come together. So because the initial analysis that the county did of critical land and where the 50% comes from was, does it become part of a development in the first place? And they hadn't previously looked at whether the land that went into a development gets houses on it or what happens to it. So that's what this 35% kind of layers on to it. Is what happens to that critical land that becomes part of a plat.
The other thing is there's also a proposal to have a half deduction or half of the critical deduction for the areas that are in the urban high in the Vancouver EGA, and that's primarily because some of the multifamily apartments really don't have as much of the issue with the critical set aside, and then for the developments in sort of smaller urban high density plats, and so that's where we're getting the 17.5% for those areas specifically.
Yeah, and again, just because the multifamily generally, if it has critical land, it stays on the same parcel. So it would be counted in the net density that the county is observing and that the county will use to set the density assumptions going forward. So we wouldn't need to deduct it out because it's being counted in that density. So this is the recommendation as it stands right now for critical lands. I think before we get into, you know, any feedback about this, I first want to just offer folks the opportunity to ask questions. I know this was new and a little confusing. So let's take clarifying questions first. Does anyone need further explanation of what is recommended or proposed here? David McDonald, go ahead, please.
Thanks. I just have one question. I'm wondering and I think I've asked this before and I don't believe I've gotten an answer, but it warrants asking again. Are the number of units on the development the same regardless of whether there's critical lands that are put into open space or not developed? Because my understanding is that if you have a parcel that has critical lands on it, even though you're not able to develop those lands where they are going to open space or something else, the developer is not denied the number of units that would be available for the zoning in that land. And if that's correct, then I wonder why we even have this deduction. So I guess that's a question for Jose, and I just need a clarification on it because I could be wrong.
I want to just make one note and then Jose, ask you to add on anything that I'm missing here. But I know that our the new approach to use observed densities will mean that what we will be measuring is the actual density of the land that ends up with a house on it. So it may be that some subdivisions are able to cluster and preserve their units. If so, we would pick that up as a higher net density. And so that new approach of using an observed net density means that we should keep this deduction because let's say they are allowed 10 units and instead of doing them all on, I'm going to make easy math, 1 acre lots, they do them all on 1/2 acre lots and they keep half of it for critical land, something like that. We would be measuring the density of those lots that emerge, which are now 1/2 acre lots instead of 1 acre lots. So to be consistent with using an observed net density, we would want to take into consideration land that is held in a separate tract for open space, whether or not they are allowed to preserve their density, because we would, if some do and some don't, we're gonna pick that up in measuring the net density, the observed net density anyway. Jose, is that accurate? And do you have anything else you wanted to add to that?
Yeah, that's accurate. The other thing is that densities are, it's a range. So there's a high and a low, there's a minimum and a maximum when you're calculating density. And so for sort of single family residential, you're excluding roads, infrastructure, and some of those critical lands. And some of the times you can use the land that is being excluded and do a density transfer to sort of increase the density, but you're still within the range. You can't exceed the range that's allowed. So there's some density value in those critical lands. But like Becky said, we're going to be looking at the net density overall. And so it's just a matter of whether this land is going to be part of the plat and whether we should categorize it appropriately.
Does that answer your question, David? You look a little puzzled still.
I am. I'm still puzzled, but that's probably because I just don't understand what you said.
I'll come
back. Let me sit on it a few minutes and why don't you go ahead?
I
understand the words and the principles.
Okay.
But I still don't see how
that makes sense.
50% deduction, a 50% number where it's not going to affect the number of units, because what we're trying to do is decide how much population we can put into the area. But I'll work on it. I'll listen to the other.
Okay. And I think that would have been a bigger concern if we were still sticking with a single assumed density versus using observed. And because the recommendation is to move to observed, I think that to me, I'm happy to try to, help explain this further, but I think with the move to observed density, it does, it should address that concern. Eric, I see you've got a hand raised.
I just wanted to help answer David's question. And typically when you have a development, if you have critical areas, you're not getting the same density. You do have some incentives, so you're able to transfer some of the density, but it's not really like a 2-for-1 where you get the same amount of density. You still have a hit on that density. So you have some incentives, you have, and every project's a little different, but I would say on average, you're definitely not getting the full density. You're maybe getting maybe 2/3 of the density you would on the whole parcel. So it really varies by project. So.
Okay. And then Are there any other clarifying questions? I think on this one, I'd like to just, if folks are comfortable, just do a go around in the interest of time and just give everybody an opportunity to say their thoughts on it. But are there any other clarifying questions or anything else anybody wants to get out before we do that?
I have a couple of clarifying questions, if I could.
Go ahead, Brian.
These were in my comments, which obviously you've seen. And so, and you partially addressed them, but I guess I'm still unclear of the, there's what appears to be have a potential for a double count in taking, I think the sample area findings that about half the land is critical land is going to develop and half won't is that seems very reasonable. It just seems that if you're taking the 35% of critical land from a different data set and that there's the potential for overlap. And so I don't think we'll be able to resolve this without me speaking with staff just offline later, just to get a fuller explanation of it. If you have anything to offer now on it that's short, go ahead and do so. The other question I had was just on the second part of my comments was, is there any data to support the recommended treatment of urban high designations regarding critical lands?
Sure. Jose, I'll take a first pass and then let you add on anything you want to clarify. But in the sort of two-step process, critical lands in this first step was identified as having developed if it got encompassed into a plat. So for example, this purple blob over here in Falcon's Nest is considered to have developed. We can see that it does not have, has some, parcels on it, but most of it does not have parcels. So I think the idea was just because it has developed in the sense that it went into a plat does not mean, to Eric's point, that it yielded housing units just like any other land. And so we want to account for that. So the part that went in to, and you can see like these chunks over here didn't even make it into a plat. So that's where that 50% comes in. It's like 50% of it won't even make it in a plat in the first place. And then the second part is of the part that makes it into a plat, how much of it becomes things like houses and roads and how much of it ends up in its own tract preserved. So that second piece said of the critical lands that go into a plat, 35% end up preserved and the balance comes out as houses or roads or stormwater or whatever else. That's out of the.
Then why not just take a single data source? Why not look at the sample area and say, okay, how much critical land made it into a plat versus not into a plat in the sample area. And then also say, okay, in the sample area of the stuff that made it into a plat, how much gets preserved? And I think that would address potential double count.
I think the reason here, and again, Jose, feel free to chime in, but I think the reason here was that the nature of the critical lands could really vary throughout the county. And we have a comprehensive countywide data set of all of the plats since 2000, and it's been overlaid with critical lands. We have the ability to do the more comprehensive look at it and say, you know, we can't do this analysis throughout the whole county, but we can do we've already done the plat analysis throughout the whole county, so it's just drawing on that broader data set because we have it, and it kind of helps deal with the fact that some critical lands are actually critical, and some of the mapped critical lands are maybe not. Jose, did you want to add or clarify anything on that?
Yeah, so I think you're absolutely right. We do the chart, the slide 13 shows the 20 years worth of inventory data that Bob has worked on to break that those out. And you can see how it varies year to year, where there's some years where you have a high amount of open space, and it just kind of varies over time. And so it just makes more sense to use that 20-year average to use as what to expect, as opposed to just using the smaller area that we looked at.
And you're satisfied, though, that the data that informed the 35% doesn't include critical lands that in the sample area would have informed your 50% estimate?
It's all just stuff that made it into a plat. So the 50% is like, did it end up in this data set? The 50% that developed went into this data set.
Okay. So it's like the 50% is the rate of critical land that's going to be converted into a flat over the 20-year period.
Okay. Well, I'll follow up, and I thank you for that. The other question, though, was about any data supporting the recommended treatment of urban high designations.
Jose, I don't know if you have any specific observations there. I think it was just an anecdotal observation about the prevalence of multifamily in Vancouver's urban high designation compared to other places.
But if those other places had fewer, single family within the multifamily designation, why would that justify the recommendation?
Jose, I think your observation was that Vancouver had the most multifamily development in the urban high, right, compared to the other jurisdictions. The other jurisdictions, the urban high is just higher density subdivisions to a large degree. So there's still even townhomes, you're seeing all the other stuff is ending up in a separate, it's not part of the net density, whereas it's only multifamily where your circulation and everything else and your critical lands are part of your observed net density.
It looks to me like Jerry Olson's been trying to get in for quite a while.
Okay, I don't mean to take any more time.
Thanks, Brian. And Jerry, I apologize. I'm not seeing or hearing anything from you, but go ahead, please.
Can you hear me? Am I muted?
Nope, go ahead. We can hear you.
I think
even now you're muted. I think you were unmuted before. Undo what you just did and then try one more time. Okay, Jerry, I'm not hearing you now, so what I'm going to propose is that we're going to go around, and when we get to you, please share whatever it is that you were trying to tell us. Okay, Marjorie Liddell, can you state whether you support this as written or have any alternatives you would like to propose?
I have the same concerns as Brian Snodgrass.
Okay, and which concern specifically?
The percentage and the data source.
Do you need further clarification or do you have an alternative that you would want to pose?
I don't have an alternative.
Okay. Is there additional clarification that would be helpful for you that we could follow up with?
Not that I could think of right this moment, but I'll think about it.
Okay. Ron Barker, how about you?
Thank you. I guess I'm running into some of the same confusion about the open space deduction. Hearing what was stated and then reading what Brian had given to us in comments, it appeared like the 35% is done before the land is divided into what will develop and what won't. So I'm wondering if that 35% of open space is really 17.5, saying that there's only 50% of the land of that, and then 35% of what is residual is going to be preserved as open space. So it's 17.5% of the total quantity. Or is it 35% of just the developable side? I see the picture, but it didn't really match what I heard when people started talking about it. And when Brian put in his comments on it and I started to review it, it made me wonder whether this was somewhat misrepresenting what we were trying to accomplish. So perhaps it's worth a little bit more discussion in that regard, just to clarify how many buildable units we would expect to see, which would then drive the discussion about density. I think observable density and what we're saying is available may be two different things in this. Thank you.
Okay, so I'm hearing a fair amount of just confusion over how this works and the two different data sets. Trying to come up with an alternative way to communicate this. I think if we take this sort of one piece at a time for urban high and urban low, this first 50% is the same assumption. 50% in both urban high and urban low does not land in a development. That's the first part of the assumption. Second part of the assumption is this orange part that does land in a development, what happens to it? And that's where it is different between urban high and urban low. So in urban low, you have this happens where this green bit becomes an open space tract, and this part gets divided up into houses and roads, and that's your 35%. If you were in urban high, our assumption is that some of it gets developed as a plat and kind of goes like this, and some of it gets developed as multifamily, and it's just all part of the same parcel. It doesn't get put into a separate tract. It doesn't get divided out separately. It stays on that same parcel, and so we don't have to deduct that land for multifamily development, which we think is about half of the development in Vancouver's urban high, the Vancouver UGA urban high designation. I'm going to suggest, if we have still a lot of confusion remaining around this, that maybe we move on, because we have a lot of other topics, and I think this is one where if we, you know, the alternative is just that it stays how it is. I think the only issue with how it is now is that right now it's assumed that 50% of it, there is a little bit of a weird overlap right now in the assumptions, that 50%, there's a 50% market factor, and then there's an additional, you still apply the vacant and underutilized factors, which is the part that I think we're trying to address. The other place where this matters is that we heard from a couple folks about the need to account for open space. And so if we don't take this approach to accounting for open space, we would need to take a different approach to accounting for open space in the infrastructure deductions. So we need to account for open space somewhere. And what we were trying to do is say, you know, based on what we observed, it looked like most of the open space that is getting set aside in subdivisions is what's mapped as critical lands in the model. That doesn't mean it's all actually critical, but it's all mapped as critical in the model. And so let's account for it through our critical lands assumptions, instead of saying all subdivisions everywhere are going to set aside open space. Let's recognize that mostly the ones that are setting aside open space are doing so because they've got mapped critical lands. So I think this is, it's related to a couple of our other pieces, but I'm thinking we might want to just keep going through the infrastructure piece and then maybe circle back and see if it makes any more sense after that. Any objections to that approach?
I'm on a Zoom call right now, so can I call you back?
Okay, hearing none. I'm going to move us forward, and we'll attempt to come back to this one. So infrastructure set-asides, this one has been subject of a couple of presentations and discussions. AHBL has done some analysis on this, and we had a recent update on it that Jose is going to give a little bit of background on, and then Nicole is going to share some of their recent work on this. This is not one that was really mandated for the county to address in this recent update, except that I would say the guidelines do definitely want you to account for infrastructure deductions and net density and things like that. But the refinement here is really driven by by concerns and comments we heard from you all. So this is, Jose will share the reason for the most recent updates, and then Nicole will talk a little bit about what the recent analysis shows.
Sure, Becky. So one of the things that has come to our attention is through a different project when we were we're in the process of updating our shoreline management plan, and the Department of Ecology through that process has sort of let us know that our wetland ordinance needs updating, and that seems like we have been a little more generous in allowing stormwater facilities within the buffers of those wetlands, and so they're really trying to emphasize that only the outer 25% of those buffers can be used, and that so and it has to be, I guess, more better integrated with the existing wetlands. And so that given that, it seems like it's going to require more land be available to be set aside for stormwater facilities, because we are using developments are sort of co-locating those stormwater facilities with those critical areas, wetlands in particular. And so just being mindful of that, we thought we would revisit this and have AHBL give us some input on that.
So with that, I'll explain that we have looked at a revised data sample. So as Jose mentioned, there's a question about where these stormwater facilities can be placed. So previously we did a lot of focus on how big do these facilities need to be. And so that's why we were looking at different stormwater manuals, different regulatory requirements for stormwater design and sizing. And now it's come to another question of, well, where can they be if they can't be in these wetland areas or buffers? How does that impact the work that we've already been doing? So we wanted to go back and revise our findings from before. So we revisited our original methodology, and we reviewed our previous calculations that we used for our previous recommendation. We did some different looking into this. What we finally found is that if we looked at just a sample of plats where there was no factor involved whatsoever of any wetland being in the area, about 6.12% of the lands in those platted areas were used for stormwater facilities. Now, we know that's a number from looking back. We know that looking forward, there's also the different factors that we've discussed before, those other dependencies, which relate to soil types, these regulatory changes in terms of new stormwater manual adoptions, and the fact that we're working this whole time to try to not double count this reduction factor with critical areas. So when we look at all of that, we've come up with a figure of 7.95. So we're bumping up our previous recommendation to this number to account for those factors and try to really look backwards and see what's been used in the past, but also look forward to see what's going to really be required for future development as we move forward. So again, I just want to emphasize we're considering the fact that there are some poor soils available for future developments in many, but not all parts of the county, but many. And so we want to emphasize that. And this sample, as I mentioned, this revised sample, it didn't fully account for those stormwater manual changes. So on the whole, this is where we've come with our recommendation. Next slide. We've also looked at our assumptions for high density residential, and this is focused in on Vancouver. So in Vancouver, we found that there's a tendency where these projects will develop with a mix of small lot detached homes, townhomes, and multifamily units. And when we're looking at that, we see that multifamily development typically has this internal circulation that's not on the public right-of-way that accommodates the stormwater, some shared open space, other facilities on the same site as housing rather than being located in separate tracts. So we looked at that, and based on the assumption that 50% of the residential urban high in Vancouver, the UGA, would be developed as multifamily, we're looking at that without the infrastructure reductions. And so finally, this gives a summary of what we're ending up with now. Our plat deduction for residential in the urban low areas, stormwater, we're at 7.95%. Roads, that's unchanged. That's still 18.6%. Utilities at 0.5% for a total of 27.05%. That's total on-site infrastructure set aside or deduction, whereas you can see the other numbers that are going to be applied for the residential urban high in the Vancouver UGA.
Okay, and I think, Jose, you were going to just give a quick update on the off-site infrastructure deduction, and then we'll take discussion, mostly focused on the on-site piece.
All right. The idea was to on the off-site, treat this as part of the demand side, looking at it when we look to size the UGA boundary and we get a new population, we use that to estimate how much land is needed to be set aside for schools and parks, because usually there's a population ratio that is associated with how those are estimated. And so the idea is to not have that as part of the model, but do it on the demand side. I think that's generally it. That's the short version.
Okay. And so our focus for today is on the on-site piece, because that's the part that goes into the model. If you have comments on the off-site piece, you're welcome to make them briefly. I would encourage us to stay focused on this piece. And I guess I'll do the same thing of starting with clarifying questions on this. Eric Galimo, go ahead.
So real quick, the existing infrastructure percentage for residential urban low density, from all the stuff I've seen before, it was 27.7% and 25% for commercial. So it looks like it's recommended to go down. I don't know where the difference is there. Maybe it's just a rounding error, but you know, previously in the model, you know, everything we've looked at before, it was 27.7% for residential. So that's the first one. The second one is there's been still two studies, and I think we're talking about the same factor here, but that DEEB did, and then also the Responsible Growth Forum, and it came out to about from looking at what projects, you know, actually happened out in the field, especially in newer areas where we're not in the city of Vancouver, we have gravelly soils. The recommendation was 32 to 35%. And there was quite a bit of research done, I think way more than that went into this. So I would recommend that we go with the recommendations from those two groups or somewhere in between. And I think one was about 38 to 40%. One was 32 to 35. So I think 32 to 35 is probably in the right ballpark. Not 27.
Just a quick point of clarification. The previous 27 was an overall aggregated infrastructure deduction, and it incorporated some open space that we later determined probably double counted with critical lands. So that's why the change there. I think, you know, we all of the consultant team and staff are familiar with the studies that you mentioned, and the work that HBL has done uses actual subdivisions, and it just uses a larger data set. So I think it's taking the same idea of let's look at what's actually happened on the ground. It's just that it's a bit more comprehensive, and you know, sometimes when you have a different sample, you get a different answer. So I think that's the reason for the distinction there. We also don't know with the DEEB study whether critical lands and open space were how those were counted. And so again, the need to be careful of double counting is the other reason why we've used AHBL's more disaggregated results.
Fitzgerald, am I muted?
Oh, yeah, Jerry, we can hear you. Yep, go ahead, Jerry.
Okay, I was responsible for most of that study. I was a little bit offended that it was downplayed because that study was 30 plus plats that were right in the office at the same time. Eric contributed to the group, but they were done by professional engineers, surveyors, and project managers using the approvals and the plats themselves on the ground. They handled the wetlands and everything appropriately according to VBLM, and that is good data. I don't know where this data comes from. Is it, it's the 7.95, is that surveyed calculated data, or is that GIS data? Where is it coming from?
Nicole, do you want to offer a clarification? I know this was on your previous slide. I can go back to it, but can you just step folks through again where that 7.95 comes from and the data set that you based it on?
I mean, when you're
muted,
using the actual...
Nicole.
I got it now. Thank you. From the very beginning, we've been working with GIS data as provided by the county, and it's sourced from the assessor's records. And then some refinement has been done to make sure that we are accounting for everything appropriately. And we looked, we kind of vetted the data to check for any abnormalities and addressed anything that we found to sort of clean things up. And then moving forward, we did revise our initial sample, which was countywide, all of the UGAs, and we took a smaller sample, which was still countywide, all of the UGAs, but only looking at those subdivisions that did not have any wetlands in or near them. So that means they were not in a wetland nor a wetland buffer, and that was what we used for our revised recommendation here recently in this last memo.
Okay. And Eric, I see you still got a hand raised. With your permission, I'm going to go to Ron Barca since he hasn't spoken yet, and then catch you once everybody's had a chance to speak. So go ahead, Ron.
Thank you. I would like some clarification on the urban high residential. It said, I think, Vancouver specifically UGA, but the survey was done within all the jurisdictions. So does it say that nobody has residential urban high other than Vancouver for this study?
No, but Jose, can you comment? You looked a little bit at the prevalence of urban high in other jurisdictions.
I think there's more urban high in the Vancouver UGA. Urban high varies from jurisdiction to jurisdiction, so they're not consistent. And the types of development that we're seeing in the urban high area in the Vancouver UGA doesn't seem to be similar to what's being done outside in the other jurisdictions. Even within the Vancouver urban high, that represents about 20% maybe of all of the land available. So most of the land is in the urban low, and it probably be even lower in the other jurisdictions.
Okay, sure. The reason I was really asking is that center bullet on the slide that's presented right now, having gone through multifamily in both Camas and seeing what's being built now in the Ridgefield jurisdiction, I'm seeing tracts that do indeed contain their own stormwater and have internal circulation that way. So I was just kind of wondering whether or not we're talking about something that was only going to be applied in the Vancouver UGA, or whether we're talking about rules that were going to be utilized throughout the entire county at all jurisdictions.
And just to clarify, so the adjusted deduction would apply in the Vancouver UGA to residential urban high. All the other, I'm realizing now this table is not clear. For the urban high in other jurisdictions, they would have this same plat deduction as the urban low. So they would just basically assume all platted, and that's not entirely true, but the majority of what Jose is observing in those areas is development that is happening as a plat. I think David McDonald has a hand raised. So go ahead, please, David.
I just need a clarification. Was this additional 30% added as a result of the potential that the county was rewriting their wetlands ordinance to comply with directives from Department of Commerce, Jose?
I think that's a question for me.
Oh, so, okay. Sorry.
No, that's fine. So what we did is we found a new number, but then we wanted to account for those other things that we had been looking at this whole time. And so we looked at it pretty closely, and we really believe that increasing the number beyond this observed, you know, looking back figure is super important. And so that's why we've added a factor to increase that. And that's not a precise number, but that's something we think is very defensible and rational to you.
Okay.
Sorry to interrupt. Yeah. Nicole, if I'm right, I think that increase is based on the bullet points listed in the middle here, which is that it isn't because the sample size was too small when you were looking at only areas that had the new stormwater, that we had to look at areas that maybe were under old stormwater as well, or time periods that were under old stormwater rules as well. And so that 6.12% doesn't account for the change. It doesn't fully account for the changes to stormwater that they've documented previously. And it also doesn't address the fact that some of that there is some shift in the soil composition of the lands that will develop in the future.
Yes, in some areas. So we didn't want to totally abandon all of the information that we had gathered previously about all these things that, as I mentioned, are kind of the dependencies of how stormwater facilities are sited and sized. Instead, we're trying to factor all of that in as best we can with the data that we have looking back.
So this data that you did in this re-study is done no matter what the county does on trying to comply or not comply with what Jose was talking about.
Oh no. The assumption is that there will be compliance on behalf of the county and other communities as they update their critical areas ordinances. They're going to need to make sure that they are putting provisions in there. This is that stormwater facilities cannot be placed in any wetlands or their buffers, except for some very minor outfall and things like that that we put in our memo. So this is in consideration of that, and it's because we want to look forward, and we know that this is on the horizon. This is going to be implemented throughout the different communities. So we want to account for that.
That's where this revised sample is saying in four plats where they couldn't double up. If we use only plats where they did not have the ability to double up their wetlands and their stormwater as our basis. And so that's how it's accounting for that new rule that going forward, you won't have the opportunity to double up. And so that's how it addresses that rule.
No, Becky, I understand that totally. And I understand what Nicole said. My issue here is that I watched the work session where the county council was being presented with the fact that they were out of compliance with the wetland ordinance and their critical areas ordinance. And the council was relatively hostile to potentially having to rewrite that. So what I'm concerned with, because I've been here a long time and seen it happen on multiple occasions, is the county will say, hey, we don't care about being in compliance with a wetlands ordinance or whatever the Department of Commerce says, and we'll wait for the growth board to tell us one way or the other. In the meantime, we are working on the good faith basis, or Nicole is, that the ordinance will be passed and adhered to. So I'm wondering, as an alternative, if we could figure out what the model will be if the county fails to make the changes that Nicole has put into her analysis.
I think the answer there is that we would probably revert back to their previous analysis that showed, I think, Nicole, 3.8 or something like that, which did that analysis was based on areas that are under the new rules, but were in some cases doubling up their stormwater and their wetlands. I won't take a position on which of those outcomes is more likely, but if you wanted to advocate for an alternative, I think that would be the basis for it.
Then just in the model, if we get to that point, that would be my alternative under what would be what, 2A?
I might need to think about what where it lands, but let's okay. Let's go ahead and do our go around of,
yes, you might put it under 2B.
Thoughts on this. Yes. It could possibly land in one of those options. David, and just to capture yours, your recommendation would be go back to prior AHBL numbers with the 3.81 or whatever it was for storm, and use those numbers.
I just want to know if the model is, I just think that the model should reflect, or at least our notes should reflect, that this change that Nicole did, if we vote for it, the assumption is that there won't be a doubling up, because if the county continues to double up, then the number that Nicole originally did is the appropriate number.
So you would want to capture that as sort of a contingency.
Correct.
Okay. Thank you for that clarification. Thanks. Okay. Let's do our go around. So Marjorie Liddell, you are up first again. What is your, what's your take on this?
I think some of the conversation's interesting. I'm inclined to go with the recommendation though at this point.
The recommendation as written here?
Yes.
Okay, thank you. Ron Barca, you're up next.
Thank you. I'm going to put on my planning commission hat here for just a moment and say that should I be presented with the need to change the stormwater ordinances, we would go forward and be doing that appropriately. And if that's the siting of those as been recommended, then I agree we should have that accounting in the very beginning, and I support this infrastructure set aside.
Okay, thank you. Eric Galamo, would you like to support or offer an alternative?
I do not support what's proposed. I'd offer an alternative. I think we should go with the data suggested by Deeb. And when I'm doing a design, if I'm going off GIS data, that's great for preliminary, but it doesn't be actual in the field measurements of actual projects, not, you know, GIS level information.
Your specific recommendation then 32%?
To go off the D memo of 32 to 35%. And that's a range based on a memo supplied by Deeb to the county council.
Okay. All right. We've got your alternative. Jennifer Baker, what's your support or offer alternative?
Well, thank you, Becky and Nicole, for amending the stormwater calculation. I think that I generally support the direction, but I would err closer on the side of the Responsible Growth Forum study and that data set that was ground truth by a number of planning experts on the ground here in Clark County. And so I would recommend either a moderated 30% or higher deduction.
Okay, so you would support the higher 32 to 35% alternative on this?
Yes.
Okay, thank you for clarifying. Jeff Swanson.
I also support the higher alternative on this one.
Okay, thank you. Jim Malinowski.
I'll support the higher alternative.
Okay. Ryan Davis.
Yeah, I support using the recommendations from D based on what has actually happened in the field.
Okay. Stephen Abramson.
Oops. I also support the higher recommendation based on the observations in the field.
Okay. Brian Snodgrass.
I support this, the project team recommendation with a modification, but first just a couple clarifying questions. How many plats did AHBL look at in not in the revised wetlands thing, but in the first plat to get their numbers in the first run?
Nicole, can you comment on that?
I don't know that number.
Head. I know it was, I believe it was every plat since 2000 in a UGA within Clark County.
Since 2002. I don't know. Yeah.
Since 2002. Okay. And then, but I'm sorry, the original one, the original version filtered things out and picked a subset of those for analysis because of the correct stormwater.
Yeah, no, I was interested in the first one. The first one that didn't filter, did it look at hundreds of plats, thousands of plats, how many?
It was hundreds of plats.
Okay.
Yeah.
The other question I had was just on the specifics of the direction from ecology regarding the stormwater within a wetland buffer. And it sounded like from the memo that their direction, as you understood it, was not to allow it at all. But then I heard earlier today that the outer quarter of the wetland buffer would still be eligible for stormwater facilities. Can you shed any light on that?
Say or Wayne?
So what I'm seeing from what's being done in the shoreline update talks about the outer quarter. So I don't know if there's anything different that Nicole and Wayne have, but that's what I've seen from those documents.
I didn't see anything talking about the outer quarter. What I did see is that there's just some limited exceptions which had to do about additional runoff treatment or flow control, where in limited cases specific criteria are met and there's mitigation applied. So from what I saw, it's really, you stay out of the wetlands, you stay out of the buffers, on the whole, except for some very small exceptions.
Yeah, and I've seen, this is Wayne, I've seen spreader trenches also allowed in the outer 25%. But yes, very limited.
So thank you. The proposed modification I'd offer is just to the Vancouver UGA. I think I don't pretend to know stormwater in detail, but I think from my understanding and also from the earlier July memo from AHBL, the Vancouver UGA is in better shape than most of the other ones in terms of its soil types. Not all of the UGA, but a good portion, and certainly a good portion of the city, and that is an important factor in the impacts of the regulations, including the new ones. So a couple of concerns on the proposed doubling, at least as applies to the VUGA, of the stormwater deduction. It appears as if the reanalysis that yielded the 6.1%. Obviously was countywide, and so it would have included a lot of plats in areas that had less favorable soils. So it may have overstated, at least in terms of Vancouver. The second part of the additional 30% bump proposed to bring 6.1 up to 7.9, the factors that you've mentioned include poor soils, and yes, there are some in the Vancouver UGA, but certainly not as many on a percentage basis, it would appear from the maps that were presented earlier, than there are elsewhere. So it's not clear why the doubling should occur in the Vancouver UGA. I would recommend in the VUGA we stick with what it was as of a month ago of the 3.9%.
Okay, so your refinement, Brian, is back to the previous stormwater for specifically the Vancouver UGA. And otherwise as written. Okay, thanks for clarifying. Okay, Jamie Housley, go ahead, please.
Yeah, first I want to respond to that, and then I want to get my suggestion in. So the Vancouver UGA is very large and encompasses an area, again, half the size of the city limits that is unincorporated Clark County. And there's a lot of swales up in the Flyta 179th area, Pleasant Valley area, even in North Orchard that aren't the good draining soils that maybe the experience in the city. So I think that's a little bit overstated. But with that being said, as one of the people that sits on DEEB and who's very familiar with that, paper and that analysis, I am very supportive of that and have been for a very long time because that is what we have seen and observed and documented now for many, many years, and it's just a simple reality that storm ponds are increasing due to the regulatory environment in Washington, and we need to keep up with the times here. So thank you.
Okay, thanks, Jamie. David McDonald.
I support the recommendation as is with Brian's amendment.
Okay.
Thank you, Ryan. My comment before with my contingency.
Okay. Noted. Thank you. Ryan McInster, go ahead, please.
Well, I'm sure by looking at that report, you guess which my feeling is, with there being a named entity on the report. I agree with the proposal that Eric has put forward.
Okay. Thank you. And Jerry Olson, I think we got Jerry's perspective earlier, but Jerry, I think what we got you is recommending the DEEB analysis. Is that correct?
The RGF version. Also, we went by offsite deductions. Are we just dismissing our ability to discuss parks and schools?
We are not. We are prioritizing because it is 4:10 on a Friday. And we are prioritizing things that help us move forward to testing in the VBLM. So if you would be willing to submit any comments on that in writing to Jose for consideration by the group, we do have your comments. So if you have any additional new comments on that that you would like to make in writing to Jose on the new recommendation.
Parks and schools make up half of the total infrastructure exemption, they'd be doubling this number, so it's a very important item to talk about.
I don't disagree that it is important. I think we have a proposal to account for it. It would not be addressed in the VBLM under this proposal. It would be addressed through the comp plan update.
I oppose that too.
Okay. If you want to make a specific proposal about it and can do so briefly, please go ahead. Otherwise, I'm going to suggest that we take like a 30-second plank break or something and then move to the next section. Do you have a proposal you wanted to make for this one, Jerry, of how it should be accounted for in the VBLM?
Yes. I propose for the VBLM we use the various parks plans and school plans for the districts to determine by formula what the TIF fees are, to determine what the acreage set aside for parks and schools should be, and to deduct that from the vacant buildable lands inventory.
Okay, we've got that noted, and we'll see if that's a thing that we can do inside the VBLM. Okay. We were supposed to have this break a long time ago, and it's not going to be 5 minutes, but I am going to propose that everybody at least stand up, do something, stretch your arms. If you need to get a drink of water, if you need to go to the restroom, if you need to attend to something that's going on outside of this call, go ahead and take, you know, a minute and do that. When we come back, we are going to talk about redevelopment and residential development in commercial areas. So you've got like 30 seconds and then we'll come back and do that. And thank you all for bearing with us. Okay, going to initiate the reconvening process and get us moving again. I will note I got a message from Jen Baker on the market analysis and noting support for retaining the 15% demand side market factor. So Jen, I'll make sure we capture that in our notes. Wanted to make sure it got said out loud so that it is part of our recording. And with that, I will move us forward. The redevelopment and residential pieces, we have a few updates on those. Jose and Margaret, I'm going to ask you to be as brief as you can in summarizing the updates. This is all covered in the memos, and for benefit of those that are tracking along in writing, redevelopment is covered on pages 3 to 5 of the PAC memo, and the survey results are on page 6 of the survey summary. So that's where the longer version of this can be found. Jose, can you go ahead and summarize the additional analysis for outside of Vancouver City Center? Oh, unless Jose is still taking his 30-second break. Nope, you're back. There you are. Go ahead.
All right. I just wanted to give a high-level framework of the next couple of issues that are dealing specifically with development on commercial land within the city of Vancouver. And we decided to break this up looking at central sort of downtown and the CX zoning and the areas outside of downtown, because we thought those were two different things, and we didn't want the downtown to influence or skew the data that we got outside of downtown. Why this is significant is that in the 2016 DBLM, the city of Vancouver, it's estimated that they're going to have a capacity of 4,500 residential units over the 20-year period. Since 2016, there have been 1,500 units developed within the commercial areas of the city, and the model doesn't account for any of that. So the redevelopment in Vancouver outside, we looked at, there were 4 acres out of 1,220 that were built since 2016. You can see what the redevelopment rate over that time is and what it would be. Extrapolated out as 1.7% over the 20-year period. I think we ratcheted that down because there's just been such a high rate of development of multifamily that's unprecedented in what we've seen. I know there's data that there's a lot more in the pipeline and that hasn't changed, but that's how we ended up with that recommendation. And the next slide. So the rationale for maintaining the 5% redevelopment factor is initially we looked at some of the unit creation over the 2016 to 2020 period, and there's an observation that there's about 6% of the units that have been created during that time period that were outside of residential land in the various jurisdictions. We looked to see if there was anything systemic that could be done or changed, but it just seemed like this was a way to capture that. All commercial areas usually allow for residential above commercial, and it just hasn't been seen. There was one example in Camas where that's happening. I talked to the folks in Camas. This was a unique thing. I don't know that they're expecting more of that. There was also another development in Camas where it had multifamily in a zone that didn't allow that allowed it. But they subsequently changed that. It wasn't intended to allow that. So there wasn't anything sort of systemic that we could do to capture those. So we think just keeping that redevelopment makes sense to capture those items that don't fall in within the residential or mixed use.
Okay. And Margaret, if you can very briefly summarize the city center.
Yeah, so we also looked at development inside the Vancouver City Center. So we took all the land designated as built in those commercial areas in Vancouver City Center and calculated a redevelopment rate between 2007 and 2019 for the residential development that occurred, and that was about 4.7%. And so extended over 20 years, that looks like about 7.9%, noting that there was a strong multifamily development market in that time frame, and so that may cool over a 20-year period. And so that led to the recommendations on the next slide, I believe. Yes. So because of that point I just made about a disproportionate multifamily market, we would recommend a 5% residential redevelopment rate to commercial land in the Vancouver City Center. And then outside of the city center, which is the area Jose talked about, we recommend a 1% residential redevelopment rate to commercial land and retain a 5% demand side assumption. And so out of those areas that would now be designated as residential in these commercial areas, we would add those to the residential land supply as net available acres and then apply a density specific to residential and commercially designated areas based on observed trends. And it's noted in the memo that those are about 30 units per acre in Vancouver outside the city center and roughly 100 units per acre in the city center. So with that, I'll open it up to clarifications, questions.
Let's start with clarifying questions first. And I know, Brian, I know you had some comments on this and I want to let you summarize those for everyone's benefit in case I haven't read them. But let's start with clarifying questions first and then I'll get to you right after that. Does anyone not understand the basis for this or not understand how it would work? Ron Barker, I see a hand raised. Go ahead, please.
I am wondering with the news of the HP campus redevelopment plan, how that is being taken into account. It seems like we really have a lot of commercial land that has this potential. We're not even considering these types of parcels as underutilized, yet they turn around and they have a plan for significant development of like 175 acres where there will be residential going into it. The Vancouver Mall, Westfield Mall, has continued to take out parking and put in additional businesses throughout it. And I'm wondering about its potential for additional residential in that commercial property and zoning as well. So it seems like we're not looking at the trends in this case. We're looking at what's already happened, and what is already happening is accelerating beyond our planned assumptions that we had through the last go around. This is one particular one where it appears like we should try to get out in front of it to be more reflective of how we believe the market is changing, and these large parcels are extremely underutilized just in their existence, acres and acres of asphalt.
So I do want to just one clarifying point there that the recommendation to retain the 5% demand side assumption is partly reflecting the fact that we know that this doesn't capture everything, and we know that there are some sites that will be difficult to predict, but that where redevelopment will occur. So that's partly intended to respond to places or redevelopment that we can't necessarily predict based on the characteristics of the parcel as they are today. And did you want to add, Jose, did you have anything you wanted to add in terms of a clarification on that?
So I think the only thing would be that I think Brian can speak to redevelopment, some of the city projects, but I think some of the larger land pieces are going to be zone changes. And so if it's an industrial property that's going to be changed to a mix of commercial and residential, the model will capture that. Secondly, there is, I know, interest in converting some commercial land for multifamily within the county along some corridors and in the Highway 99 area. But there's no, it's hard to predict or what would we use as a basis for estimating how much and at what density, because there's just nothing in existence. So that's part of the issue. Using the 5% gives us a chance to still capture some of that. And as new data comes, we can make adjustments and account for things as they come on board.
Okay. And then, Brian, can you briefly summarize the comments that you submitted and the any concerns or refinements that you would want to propose here?
Sure. Thank you. I can only speak for Vancouver, but I think this misses something fairly significant. The recommendation appears to be based mostly on looking at past data, which is normally fine. I think in this case, though, when there's a clear trend and data backing that trend, it needs to be partially considered as well. One problem with relying just on recent history of redevelopment rates in Vancouver, a couple problems. One is that the assessor data has a lag in it, so you effectively miss most of the last year. It's also, it seems like in this case, and correct me if I'm wrong, that this is just redevelopment of commercial lands that developed for residential. It didn't include redevelopment of residential lands. And I know that was keeping the existing demand side assumption was based partially on, I think the 6% figure was quoted. If I heard right, though, that was development outside of Vancouver. So I think the look at the past that is driving this assumption isn't fully complete because it didn't consider redevelopment of residential lands. But I think the biggest concern is that it doesn't consider what data shows us is likely to occur. As I included in my comments, the city has basically appears to have finalized about 200 apartment units a year for the last few years. We now have 6,500 in the pipeline. Even if, as is likely, not all of those develop and some of those take some time, that's going to greatly influence future data. And I think some effort needs to be made to include that here, given that is information feeding into this. And I think also in some of the other assumptions, we've used judgment, or the recommendation at least has been to use judgment. We saw that with the 30% bump up on the stormwater issue, for instance, and several of the other recommendations have also used judgment. I think in this case, there's some data. It's a little harder to do in terms of redevelopment than the development on unused commercial land. I think if I had to pick a number off the top of my head, I would suggest 15 or 20%. Citywide. I think better than that, though, is and I can help the project team if you want or not, but is coming up with a recommendation that looks at the past growth, yes, but then also looks at what's in the pipeline and considers both. And if the project team can do that, that's great. I think we'd be in a lot better position than this recommendation, which I think falls pretty far short.
Okay, thanks for summarizing, Brian. I see Jamie Housley, you've got a hand raised. Go ahead, please.
Yeah, I guess I'm extremely frustrated with that whole line of logic that Brian's offering up here. And, you know, number one, a lot of those sites of redevelopment, like in Section 30, you know, they're under development agreements that sort of allow for unique things. And so I don't think counting on that as a basis for real world observations is very good. But more importantly, you know, using this speculative forecast of what may or may not occur in Vancouver, to me, that is dubious. And it's not, you know, one of the criticisms we've kept hearing from staff for a long period of time is, you know, just take the stormwater stuff, for instance, where we're telling you that the new regulatory environment is going to have significant impacts on the amount of land set aside for stormwater impacts. And yet, you know, the response we've gotten for staff is over the years is, well, we need to wait and see how that plays out. And so, you know, what's good for the goose is good for the gander. I'm sorry, this is just, I have to call it out.
Okay, Jamie. Others, let's see, I see David McDonald, you have a hand raised. And I would say, I would encourage folks to keep your comments focused on the subject matter. I know there's some long histories in this area, but I would encourage folks to focus on the recommendation and anything that you would propose to do differently in terms of the recommendation here. So go ahead, David. Thank you.
So I've listened to what Brian has said, and I've listened to what Jamie has said, but I haven't heard what either Margaret or Jose believe when they look at the data that's provided to them from Brian, how they think that should or should not play into the model. So I know that Brian's comments came out relatively soon. I mean, just day yesterday, I think, is when I saw them. And so I think it would be helpful to hear what they say after they look at those. You know, I understand Jamie's frustration, but his logic can be turned around and used against him the same way, because he wants to project how all of these stormwater infrastructure things are going to impact, and he votes that way, and then he turns around and says that it's not going to work for this particular thing. So I don't really want to get
just
to
a reminder that we're going to try to
I know
Becky, leave the people as much as we can out of this.
I
thank you.
But what I'm saying is I don't want to get into a tit for tat for it. What I'm suggesting is what we do is let Margaret and Jose and your team look at Brian's numbers, talk to him about them, and then give us your evaluation of what he is saying so that we can better evaluate it. That would be my request.
David, I can't let this rest. I'm sorry.
Jamie, our stuff
that we were suggesting was based on real world observed data on the stormwater side.
Jamie, I hear your frustration there. I would, for everybody, if we can try not to direct our comments to specific other PAC members. I understand a long history here. But let's try to stay focused on the recommendations. If I can summarize, I think there's a set of data that Jose and Margaret presented, and the question is whether we expect future trends to push up or down from there. Jamie, I don't know if you disputed the data itself or just whether it is an appropriate basis for forward-looking analysis, but I think the question at hand is whether, in light of what Brian is seeing, looking at the pipeline and other factors in terms of market cycles or other things, whether we would expect redevelopment to be above or below historic trends. I don't know that I've heard anyone say we should not base this in any way on historic trends. Eric, I see you have a hand raised. I think I'd like to make this the last open-ended comment and then give everybody a chance for a closing comment.
I don't disagree with it. I wonder if this is the right place to put it. And it's one of those things where do you put it in the assumptions? Because this is something that the council, city council, and the county council use when they look at rezone requests. And the indication of the past has no indication of what's going to happen in the future. So if you're going to consider that they're going to rezone, 5% of residential to commercial, I don't know that that's a fair assumption. I would put it in here. So I don't say it doesn't happen. I just don't know if this is the right place for it. So,
okay. All right. So I'm gonna run
doesn't
through.
Doesn't have anything to do with zone changes.
Oh, I'm sorry, Jose. Yeah, go ahead. Go ahead and clarify, please.
This has nothing to do with zone changes. This is commercial that's currently allowed and that's being developed, and the model doesn't capture it because the model assumes no development on commercial land.
But in the case, don't we have another one we're talking about after this, which is commercial, residential, and commercial areas? So are we double counting?
Thank you for asking that clarifying.
Because there's two different things. This is redevelopment. Yep. So this is commercial land that's currently built, mm-hmm. and now it's being redeveloped as residential. Hmm. The other is vacant commercial land that's being developed as residential.
Yeah. So in both cases, we're trying to capture the new residential development. The thing is that some of it is happening on built land. So just applying a split wouldn't capture it. So we need to apply a redevelopment rate to capture it. And then on the vacant and underutilized land, we can take the same land that was already assumed to develop. We just need to acknowledge that some of it is developing as residential under its existing zoning.
Hmm.
Okay. So I'm going to do a go around and try to get closing thoughts on this one. Marjorie Liddell, are you still with us on the phone? And can you, if so, can you give your closing comment on this?
Yes, I would like to hear staff response to what Brian Snodgrass raised.
Okay, so I guess if, would you like a brief comment on that now or a more in-depth comment on that later?
I don't have a strong preference. Given the time, I would say probably later.
Okay. I know, Jose, you've had a chance to look at it just briefly. And again, I think the question is whether how much weight to put on the pipeline compared to the past trends. And Marjorie, do you, I guess, can I separate this out? Do you agree with the recommendation to account for residential redevelopment in Vancouver's commercial land? And the question is whether we should be above or below or at historic trends?
I think it should be above historic trends, probably.
Okay. All right. Thank you for clarifying. Ron Barca, can I get your closing thoughts, please?
Yes. I believe that the 5% as written in the recommendation probably underserves what we anticipate seeing. And that key word in the anticipation, as Jamie pointed out, Section 30 is somewhat planned out, but the HP development for that 175 acres is not included in the Section 30 development by itself. And the residential planning that's going on now was not included in that. So if staff wants to bring forward items in the pipeline, including Section 30 and things that we know are going to be the case and ground truth it against the 5%, I think it would be worth the look ahead to see what that looks like, because I believe the economic pressures are going to be pushing us for both this and the vacant lands.
Okay, so your recommendation would be to include it at or above the historic rate?
Absolutely.
Okay. Okay, Eric Galemo, can I get your parting thoughts, please, on this one?
I'm kind of neutral on it. I feel like I don't have a firm grasp of what it's going to do. And it kind of depends on where we're at in the next one. So
okay. So you do not object to including it and testing it in the base case for the VVLM, if that's what
I'd like to see the tested. Yeah, I'd like to see how it's tested and what the results are, but okay. I'm not going to support it at this point either.
Okay. Jennifer Baker, are you still with us, Jennifer?
I am. Hi, Becky.
Thank you.
I have just one clarifying question. Does any of the modeling take into account sales tax revenue lost from the redevelopment of commercial land, or is it estimated that the sales tax revenue is zero because it's deemed underutilized or somewhere in between?
The model does not predict or address sales tax revenue to my knowledge. So it would just address capacity for additional commercial development and there's no, I would say there's I think the proposal is that there would be 5% assumed, 5% of the employment growth is assumed to be accommodated through redevelopment somewhere, but otherwise there would not be a, there's no site-specific employment land redevelopment assumption. Does that answer your question? And Jose, do you have anything you want to clarify? Jose, does that answer your question, Jennifer?
I couldn't actually hear Jose. So
he said sales tax revenue is not considered.
Okay. Yeah, I just need to noodle this one for a minute.
Okay. Would you like us to come back to you?
Sure.
Okay. All right. Jeff Swanson?
I'm with Eric on this one. I think we should test it.
Okay, so you would like to test it as written and see impact compared to current
yes.
assumptions. Okay, thank you. Jim Malinowski. Jim, it looks like you are on mute. Can you unmute yourself and tell us what you think?
Excuse me. Yes, I see no reason to not to support the recommendation, so I support it.
Okay. Thank you. Brian Davis.
Yeah, I fall in the camp where I would like to dive in a little deeper and sort of run some of the numbers and kind of continue this conversation. You know, I appreciate Brian bringing some insight to the conversation and bringing up Section 30. I guess one question that I would have in relation to Section 30 is, you know, certainly acknowledging that it's a major project, you know, and something that we should be paying attention to. I wonder how much weight it adds and whether it's considered an outlier in regards to, you know, forecasting and looking ahead, you know, basically the question of how many Section 30s do we think are going to occur in the next 20 years? And with that answer, how much weight should it carry into the model? So I don't have the answer to that, but that's, I think, something for us to consider.
Okay. And I guess, do you support the idea of using historic trends adjusted either up or down to account for residential redevelopment in Vancouver?
I'd
and
like
the question
to get...
is, it should be up or down, or are you questioning the starting premise as well?
You know, I just want more information right now. I want to see some of the model being run and
okay. Well, that is our next step is to run the model. So I think the question is just what would you like to see tested? And if you don't have an alternative that you want to propose right now, then that's fine.
I don't have a specific alternative right now.
Okay. All right. Thank you. Brian Snodgrass, I think I skipped Stephen Abramson. Stephen Abramson, what's your wrap up for this one?
I tend to agree with what's looking like the majority, which is I don't have enough information to make an intelligent decision. The numbers seem low to me, and I think they need to be tested against the model.
So you would like to see it tested as is, or would you like to see something tested that is at or above historic rates of redevelopment?
I think above.
Okay. So you would like to see us test an option that is above historic redevelopment rates,
right.
Weighted more towards the pipeline and possible other factors.
Exactly.
Okay, thank you for clarifying. Okay, Brian Snodgrass, I think we've got that down as your position as well, is that it would be at or above historic trends based on what you see in the pipeline. Is that correct?
That is correct, and just for those historic trends should include historic development of residential land as well as historic development of commercial land. And very quickly to clarify what is on the list, this isn't a list that I put together. It's circulated internally and I believe to some extent externally about once a month by the city. It does not include speculation of where a future rezone occurs or it's not. The vast majority of these are apartments that have been proposed without any kind of zone change or anything like that. So it's in the record. I put an earlier version of it in the record back in February. I'd encourage anyone who has concerns about what it is or doesn't do to have a look at it.
Okay. Thanks for clarifying, Brian. Jamie Housley. Still with us? possibly Jamie Housley had to jump off. I don't see him on the line now. So I will, if I see him pop back up later, I will ask him for his parting thought. David McDonald.
I agree with Stephen and Brian. I think that it's important that we have this, and both redevelopment of commercial lands as well as subsequently in vacant commercial lands being put aside for residential development. So I agree with using historic trends. I would agree also that I would like to see us run it with a higher, you know, number above the historical trend to see if it works. I mean, we're looking to see whether or not we really are going to have that kind of growth in the 20 years. And if we are, we need to have that number within the model.
Okay. Thanks, David. Ryan McKinster, you still with us?
Yeah, I am. Great. Yeah, I think I'm kind of along the lines of other people, but I would say even more unknowledgeable about this. I mean, I can't make a decision either way. I mean, I only have enough knowledge right now about this to even make a decision about any of it. So whatever the group decides to put in the model, I fully support going ahead to see what that looks like. But
okay. So willing to test it as written and reserve judgment until you see the results.
Sure.
Okay. Fair enough. Jerry Olson.
Oh, I don't know. This is cold for me. Vancouver is going to be some redevelopment. Is it a trend we're looking at long term, or is it a result of temporary situation? I've been watching apartment developers frantically looking around for anything they can build on, and that would include commercial if it was all at all permitted. So I have no idea whether this is a trend or not. I guess you can test it as is. I question whether you retain the 5% and add the new 5% in.
Okay. All right. Okay. So we are at time. There are some things that we have not talked about yet, including the mixed use, commercial and residential, a quick clarification on a few things on the employment and residential land classifications. We have not had an opportunity for public comment. And I again, since the thing we do next is we are going to run the model with an approximation of your recommendations in it, I think I would like to prioritize, I want to make sure that we give our opportunity for public comment, so I want to make sure we have our chance for that. And I'd like to maybe just ask a couple of more narrow questions about the remaining items, if folks are willing to bear with us for a few more minutes. I would also like to end this meeting no later than 5 p.m. because I think that is the latest I can in good conscience keep anybody on a Friday. So what I'm going to propose is that we do a brief break for public comment and then come back for just a couple more things where we will do some more narrow questions to help us make sure we are testing the things that you want us to test, and then wrap up. So, and Eric Lemo, I don't know if your hand is still raised from before or if you have a question at the moment. Do you have any objections to that approach, or shall we go to public comment now? Okay, assuming your hand is just still raised from before. Okay, so if you are on the line and would like to offer a public comment, please let me know now. I know we have at least a couple members of the public that have hung with us for this long. Anybody? Members of the public?
I see Susan on there.
And I got cut off for some reason.
Oh, are you? Yeah, I'm sorry. I don't know if I have had a couple of times where RingCentral gives me issues after a particularly long meeting. So I don't know if folks are having technical difficulties. But Susan, did you have, I see a couple of phones, and Susan, does anyone want to make a public comment? Okay, Susan, if you're having technical difficulties and you want an opportunity later, I will try one more time at the end. Last call, whoever's on the phone, did you have a public comment? Okay. All right. I will give one more opportunity at the very end if folks do have a comment. Okay. So our remaining pieces, we have the other half of the residential and commercial, which is what happens on the vacant and underutilized land. What I'm going to do is I am going to skip past all the great analysis that Jose and Margaret did and skip to the proposed recommendation and just do a quick go around for any questions or comments on this or alternatives that you would like to propose. I think in some of the comments and survey results we saw, there was some question about whether it was appropriate to apply this within the city center only or throughout Vancouver. To clarify, this would not affect this would only be within the Vancouver UGA. Eric Galimo, did you have a question or comment?
I did. Am I back? I think I got lost for a second.
Yeah, we can hear you. Go ahead.
Okay, good. Sorry about that. You know, just to keep it really quick, I don't want to comment and take too much more time, but I was digging through the projects that were used for justification for the numbers, and I noticed a few anomalies. I just wanted to bring your attention. Like, for example, a lot of the upcoming projects were things, in particular, Acero Parkside. Those were projects that had a DA that would not be allowed today under the current code. It was a special exception. That was most of the units in the pipeline, or not most, but a good portion of them. And you might want to look into those a little bit quicker or a little bit further, because the way those developed are not going to develop in that manner in the future. They were a special exception. Also, a lot of these in here are pre-apps, and I don't think you can count on them. Also, in the ones that were used to justify the commercial zones outside downtown Vancouver, a lot of those also were special situations. They were in areas like, say, Uptown Village, areas with special overlays, or areas with a DA. So I don't think you can apply this data to all the commercial zones outside of downtown Vancouver blanket. There's areas like Uptown Village where commercial is allowed. And if you take that data and you apply it, you're going to overcapture this area. And I don't think it's going to be accurate.
Okay, so to clarify, you would like to see staff rerun the results, but excluding projects that are sort of a one-off, and you might have some suggestions about specific ones to exclude.
Yeah, there's quite a few of them in there.
Okay, and if you'd also like to provide a specific list to staff, I think that'll make it easier to consider that in detail.
Okay, and also when you look at commercial zones like Uptown Village, where a lot of these projects are, it's kind of grouped in with downtown and the way it's developing and what's allowed. So when you look at areas, say, East Vancouver or Central Vancouver in some of the commercial zones, you're not going to see as much commercial developing you're not going to see as much residential over commercial because of the way those areas, the character of those areas. So okay. There's a few different categories here. And,
okay. I think we've got your comment, Eric. Anyone else have a burning comment on this before I do a quick go around for any just one by one for any questions or your feedback on it? Okay. I see one phone number. I'm getting a little bit of background noise from you. If you can go ahead and unmute on your end, that'll ensure that you can unmute yourself if you need to. So Marjorie Liddell, any questions or comments on this? Are you comfortable with testing this in the model? Is there an alternative that you would prefer?
Testing the model is a good thing.
Okay. All right. Thank you. Ron Barca, do you support testing this model, or do you want to propose an alternative?
I think that we should be testing the recommendation using the data that's provided, even though, as Eric has pointed out, they're all one-offs. I also know that every one-off continues to breed other one-offs, and I don't see that the trend wouldn't continue. But I'd like to see it tested in this fashion.
Okay, test as written. Okay, Eric, I think we got your request was to reevaluate and possibly test whatever comes out of that reevaluation, which was probably a little bit lower than these numbers.
Yeah. One other item, though, too, and that is that by doing something like this, it eliminates, or not eliminates, but it reduces the variety of housing types. So when we look at creating a lot of the available, like, commercial area for residential, it takes area out of residential, and you end up with kind of this rental culture or apartment culture with more downtown living above commercial. It eliminates diversity, which we also need to incorporate somewhere else. So just kind of, it might have unintended consequences by adding too much of this into the model.
And but, again, this won't affect zoning or the actual ability to develop residential versus in different areas. It's just simply reflecting what the zoning allows. But I think I hear your concern that this might pick up a lot of apartments that are apartment capacity, which might take away from the overall gap that you would see for residential. Okay, I'm going to keep this rolling. Jennifer Baker, and I don't, if you want to, at the same time, we didn't come back to you on redevelopment. So can you let us know whether you would want to test this and the redevelopment as written, or offer a an alternative that you would rather see us test? Possibly lost Jen Baker, unfortunately. Okay. Jeff Swanson.
Yeah, I'm okay with testing the recommendation.
Okay. Jim Malinowski, do you want to see tested as written, or do you want to propose an alternative?
I have no alternative to propose, so I'll support the recommendation.
Okay, thank you. Ryan Davis, test as written, or propose an alternative?
Yeah, I mean, I'm fine testing it as written, but I would want to get some clarification on some of those special exemptions. And I'd also like to, and maybe it's in the data that staff provided, but get a better definition of what the city center is, because my suspicion is that there, you know, might be some areas in that wouldn't quite hit these targets. So I'd really like to know what. Okay, awesome. All right. Well, I'm not going to take up time, but yeah, I'm fine sort of running the model and just seeing what that looks like as written.
Okay. Okay. Thank you. Let's see. Stephen Abramson, would you like to test as written or propose an alternative?
I think to test as written, unless there's a way to test it excluding the properties that wouldn't be allowed under current code.
Okay. All right. So if possible, remove the things that were not allowed under the existing zoning code and use that result instead.
Correct.
Okay. Thank you for clarifying. Okay. Brian Snodgrass, test as written, or do you have an alternative?
Well, as I understood it, there was going to be more than one set of assumptions tested. So I think one of those assumptions should be a recommendation that does reflect the trends, and if somebody wants to scrub those trends to look at area that data that isn't appropriate, that's fine. But when I put the pipeline data first in the record back in February, that also included an analysis of how much of that of commercial land was going to residential for commercial. Slightly over half of the commercial land was going to residential. And so that's quite a bit more than this. I'd recommend one of the tests be 40%. Which is halfway between what that pipeline data showed and the 25% number, which is what we got when we ran the recent historical data outside of downtown.
Okay. Okay. Jamie Housley, what would you like to see? Do you want to see us test as written, or do you have an alternative? Oh, Jamie, unless he's back, I think has had to drop off the call. Don't see him back. Okay, moving on. David McDonald.
So I agree that the that we should be looking at what is the true data here. I don't know about Brian's data. I know Brian, and so, and I've read his piece from February. So I don't see why we shouldn't test that, because if we're, whether or not, I don't think that Eric's thing about diversity of housing really is, what we have to focus on in this particular, part of the model, because, there's varieties of zoning all over the county. So what I would like, and I agree with, Ron, that I have seen runoff become multiple one-offs, and every person then builds on that one-off over time. So I think that what we should do is stick with what historical trends are and then test those along with what Brian has put in, and whether or not those things that he has said are valid in what we should put in the model.
Okay, so you would like to see testing trends and something closer to Brian's more pipeline-weighted version.
I think so, yeah.
Okay. Ryan McInster, are you still on the call? And what did you see us test?
Yeah, I had to go online because I get to sit in this bridge traffic. I think we want to run it with the model as is. I like Stephen's idea, see if you can pull out some of the problems that Eric had questions with, but I'm not sure how feasible that is. That's
okay,
it.
So if possible, rerun without the sort of exceptions and use that number, and if not, test as written?
Perfectly stated. Thank you.
Okay, thank you. Jerry Olson, test as written, or do you have an alternative you'd like to suggest?
Save time. I agree with Eric.
Okay. Try to pull out the one-offs and use that number if possible. Okay, we are at 5:01. Last call for anybody who's on the line for public comment who tried and failed to be able to speak up earlier. Okay, not hearing any. We did get some written comments, public comments, and so I would direct the committee's attention to those to make sure that you're aware of the written comments that we did receive. What I will say, we did not double back on the critical lands. Since what we are going to do is test things, what I propose is that we test what we came up with and continue to try to explain it better. And we test that against the existing methodology, and that I think that might help all of us understand how much difference it makes, and that we revisit that next time. There were a few other small things where it was not entirely clear that we have support for it, but on those, I'm going to say we will test it with and without, and we will report back to you. And so if we're not sure, we will include it in one option and not include it in another option and try to use that as a way to help folks see whether it matters. And so what we'll do between now and the next meeting is try to wrap all this into the best, most reflective options we can, and run those in the model as best we can, with many pleases and thank yous to Bob Poole for testing some options for us. And then report back to you in, I believe, November. And Jose, I am trying to remember, I don't think we have that next meeting on the books yet. Oh, we do. November 20th, the Friday right before Thanksgiving week. So that is when we are scheduled to come back to you with results and give you another chance to see where we land in terms of recommendations out to council. Jose, anything you want to add on that in closing?
Thanks for all your work and getting through a lot of material. There'll be more to come as we get results of this, and we'll try to get those things to you in advance as much as possible. If you have feedback that you were wanting to give us on modifications to some of these, please send those as soon as possible.
I have another suggestion. Can we look at not Friday afternoon, especially before the Thanksgiving week?
I am for that, Eric. But I don't know if, Jose, what's your feeling about trying to find an alternative meeting? Are you willing to send out a doodle poll and see if we can find an option, or what do you want to do?
Sure. Yeah, I'm open to that. Yeah, I'll send something out.
Okay. I think if we can find an alternative that works at least as well for everybody, I am perfectly happy to do that. Also, I would just prepare yourselves that I think we're going to have another long meeting next time, because I know there's still a lot of things that people want to talk about, and that we're trying to wrap this up. I know it's hard. It's always hard to get to conclusions. So I think Friday afternoons are a tough time for long meetings, and if we can find another time that gives us a little bit maybe more of a better, more energetic time for committee meetings, we will do so.
Thank you.
But thank you all for hanging with us through a very long meeting. I really appreciate it. And yes, please do send anything else that you want considered to Jose as soon as you can. Thank you so much, and we will see you again in November.
Thank you.
Thank you.